You are listening to Mining Stock Education, where you'll learn from the top leaders in the natural resource sector and uncover quality mining investment opportunities.
This decade coming up ahead of us is the energy decade. What we saw in tech, we're going to see in energy. We're going to see this in everything from, you know, investment in nuclear energy, investment in renewables, oil and gas. I think this is a situation where we're going to see a massive spike in investment in energy.
Thanks for tuning into MSC. I'm Bill Powers, your host. In today's show, you're going to get a perspective of how a resource investor, Jamie Keach, that's who I'm speaking of, he's my guest, returning guest, has been investing his money and where he sees the best opportunities. Jamie, welcome back onto the show. It's been quite a while. I didn't look up how long, but it feels like a long time since you were back on the show. You're a resource investor. You're the lead investor with a group called ResourceInsider.com, which is a newsletter and investment firm for accredited investors. And you're also the executive chairman of Vita Carbon, a carbon credits investment firm. So you got many hats in the fire in terms of speculative venture capital in the resource sector. So tell us where you've been seeing the best opportunities and putting your money.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill. It's funny you say that. I was thinking on the last time we talked on camera has been, it's got to be at least a year, I would say. And it's been a busy year. And you know what? It's been a very different 2 years. You know, when I first started coming on your show, talking about Resource Insider, talking about what we were doing there, it was all junior mining stocks all the time. Still makes up a very, very big part of my personal portfolio and what we do at Resource Insider. Gold, copper, uranium, lithium. I think we're looking for nickel pretty hard. So we've built a portfolio in the sort of standard junior mining, mid-tier mining commodity firms. But over the last 18 months, 2 years, we've added what I would say is another product to our portfolio. I started seeing money coming out pretty heavily of the call it venture stage commodity sector after the pandemic, and started thinking to myself, okay, I'm a commodity investor. This is something I know very well. I want to start putting my money not just into the venture businesses, which is made up a huge part of my personal portfolio, far too much probably than I would recommend for anyone that doesn't spend 99% of their waking hours doing this, and into cash flowing businesses, real cash flowing commodity businesses. Because what I kept finding, and I'm sure you found this too, and many of your listeners, is that you invest in some super promising exploration stock that's going to do blah, 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 and drill this hole and make a discovery or expand a resource. And it may be run by very good people. It may do everything right, but the market timing is not working for it. Or things take longer than they think it's going to take, or any number of setbacks or slowdowns. And they're just having no cash flow is obviously such a crutch. And they just get hammered again and again with lower and lower financings, driving the share price lower, diluting existing shareholders. And so I started thinking, where can I start allocating my own money into cash flowing businesses? And I chose private businesses. That's a world that I understand well and I like very well. And you mentioned some of the things. So I'm the chairman of and helped launch a company called Vita Carbon. Vita Carbon is a carbon credit investment firm. Now, a lot of people listening to this are going to have strong views on carbon credits one way or the other. My view has always been this. The government is making strides to implement carbon taxes, to implement mandatory reductions of carbon emissions. I want to be long where all that government money is going, and I want to look at that as a hedge for my everyday life and my exposure to fossil fuels. So Vita Carbon is on track to be a cash flowing business this year. It's still small. It's still a startup. It's still private. We hope and intend to list the company at some point, but we're starting to make revenue now. We think we'll be profitable by the end of 2024. In addition to that, on the exact opposite side, we brought to members of Resource Insider, my own money. We did a oil and gas investment in Oklahoma with a small team there. We're buying old wells and royalties. So we're buying and refurbishing what you call stripper wells, basically vertical wells. These are things doing a few barrels a day, maybe 10, 20 barrels a day. Tiny, tiny assets for major or mid-tier oil companies. It's not worth their time to fix them. And so our team down there, I'm not involved in running it, I'm an investor in it. Our team is basically buying these things for pennies on the dollar, sometimes like almost free, so that these majors can just kind of get rid of them and get them off their books. And what they're doing, and they've got a lot of experience with this in their whole career, is basically squeezing every last drop of oil. They're improving the efficiency. They're able to do that because, you know, they're a team of five guys. Their overhead is very low. This has been their whole career doing this stuff. So the costs of doing that for safety and reporting and overhead and blah, 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 are a fraction of what it is for these major oil companies. And so that's been one oil and gas cash flowing business we've invested heavily in. And then finally, we just bought a frac sand terminal. A terminal is basically a transportation and storage facility, in this case for frac sand, which is the sand used in fracking. So a very high grade white pure sand. And that's an infrastructure business that's heavily leveraged to energy prices. So again, different than what we've traditionally done at Resource Insider, but I would say so far unequivocally the right choice for what's been going on in the market, and certainly the mayhem and carnage that's been going on in the junior exploration market the last 18 months.
Jamie, if
I answer your question, that was a rant.
You did, and a couple of reflections after hearing you share that. If a new listener hasn't been exposed to your investment philosophy before, and they hear, okay, he's the lead executive for a carbon credit investment firm, and then he immediately goes and says, oh, and by the way, I've been investing in oil and gas and fracking in the States, they might say to themselves, wow, what's the inconsistency there? But I think it's not just philosophical what you're doing. You're looking in terms of at this in terms of an investor, and you're looking at a product. And you're saying these two products and these two opportunities can make me money. Is that a good articulation of?
So to clarify, I am not a politician, nor am I an investor, and I am not trying to change or adjust public policy. My goal here is to invest my own money and help other people invest their money in things that make more money. The end. My expertise is commodities and hard assets, and that's where I want to spend my time. So the thesis on this, and I could spend hours talking about this, but it's very simple. There is a tremendous amount of forced investment into decarbonization, right? Tax, tax incentives, everything is changing, and pressure is being put on corporations to decarbonize and to invest heavily in renewables and that sort of thing. The reason I helped start and helped lead a carbon credit company is because there are billions and billions and billions of dollars, theoretically, that are committed to buying carbon credits. There's going to be a huge inflow of cash. Now, if corporations do what they say they're going to do, you see something like the majority, I think it's over half now, of the Fortune 2000 companies have committed to decarbonization. And there is no path to doing that without buying carbon credits, and the market has to grow, depending on who you ask, and there's opinions on this, but 10 times, 100 times more. And just like most commodity products, you can't turn on a carbon credit generating project overnight. There's a relatively long lead time. That will likely lead, if this flow of demand comes in, to a supply crunch. When there's high demand, low supply, like any other commodity, prices tend to go up. We saw this in carbon credits in 2021 and 2022, that prices just rocketed. And they've come off least recently, and people have said, well, you know, carbon credits are dead. But that's not true. That's not true at all. If you take out the extreme peak in late 2021 and just look at where we are in 2024, volumes are higher than they've ever been any year except for that year. Prices are still near all-time historic highs. So This is a product that people are buying. Do you think they should be buying it, Bill? Should they have to buy it? I don't have an opinion on that. My opinion is that they are going to buy it, and they're probably going to be forced to buy it at some point. And I want exposure to that, because already in Canada, I'm paying carbon tax now, and it's, I'm not going to get into it. I'm not happy about it. And this is my hedge to that. So that's part one. That's why carbon credits. Part two, oil and gas. Why would I buy oil and gas? Well, all of that money that has historically been devoted to oil and gas is being sucked out of that sector. There's so many, now this has come off a bit in recent months, but there are so many institutions and firms that have said, we will not support oil and gas, we will not invest in coal or energy or blah, 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 blah. We're going to redeploy all that money into renewables or some such thing. Okay, maybe they don't all pull it out, but if even half they do, you're going to see major, major underinvestment in these assets. And, you know, believe it or not, the world still needs oil and gas day in, day out to function. Not only that, is oil consumption is still rising year after year after year. So you're seeing growing demand and you're seeing capital pull, you're seeing underinvestment in supply. Again, it's the same thesis as carbon credits, but the opposite side of the coin. I think there's going to be a supply crunch because it's underinvested. I want exposure to oil. I want exposure to gas. I want exposure to, in the case of the frac sand terminal, infrastructure that gives me more exposure to oil and gas. Our thesis here at Resource Insider, a big part of it, is an energy thesis. It's, I think, we'll see if I'm proven right, but this decade coming up ahead of us is the energy decade. What we saw in tech, we're going to see in energy. We're going to see this in everything from, you know, investment in nuclear energy, investment in renewables, oil and gas. I think this is I think this is a situation where we're going to see a massive spike in investment in energy. And so that's what we're building, a balanced portfolio focused on commodities to give and help give ourselves and the investors that invest alongside us exposure to that trend.
So I've talked to a lot of fund managers, many of whom I respect, and they say they start with the micro or the bottom up view when they look for investing. What you're articulating is my approach also. You go top down where you find the big macro move and then you try to find the best opportunities that'll profit from that macro move. Is that right?
It's both, I would say. It's both. You know, if we go back to when I started Resource Insider in 2017, 2018, you know, I'd been an engineer for my entire career up to that point. I'd worked in both very technical roles and corporate development roles at primarily mining companies. And I came in with a very, very micro approach, looking at, in that case, I started heavily with gold and copper assets because that's what I really understood the best. And frankly, because those are what are most available, you know, if you look at the listed mining companies, I don't know what it is, like 60% of them are gold. So lots of products to go invest in, and I had an expertise in it. And that worked really, really well for us. So we built a strong gold, copper, and a little bit of uranium portfolio in 2018, 2019. You know, the first 2 years of building the portfolio, it was like, meh. Like we basically traded sideways. I think we lost a bit of money on some of our positions. And then, as you will well recall, Bill, 2020 hit and a whole lot of money blooded into the gold space. And all our positions, you know, doubled, tripled, went up many times. And, you know, I felt like a genius because I had made all the right choices. And I had made the right choices, certainly, in terms of the positions we took. But the thing is, almost everything went up too, right? Good, bad, ugly, didn't matter. And then we made some, I thought, strong investments during that summer of 2020 when, you know, Goldman Sachs was calling for $3,000 gold and everything was ripping. And then, you know, 6 months later, the bottom fell out of the gold market and we got, you know, crushed on those things. And it was a hard lesson. And, you know, a hard lesson for me that, like, commodities are all about macro. Like, you do have to choose the right deal, the right business to invest in, the right assets to own. But, you know, it doesn't work if commodity prices don't work in your favor. And that's the great thing about commodities, that they can go from a 5-cent stock to a dollar stock in days or weeks in that right environment, but they can also go the other direction. So you have to have both. And I have learned that.
You also mentioned or you contrasted non-revenue generating exploration stocks versus these cash flowing entities and hopefully growing cash flow stories that you're now involved in.
Yeah.
In self-reflecting, and Jamie, this is something I've asked myself through some of my losses amidst my other wins in cash flow generating companies, is that what's the difference between becoming jaded versus becoming wiser? If you become jaded and you become overly cynical in a non-healthy way that perhaps could cause you to miss opportunities versus becoming wiser. Any thoughts here?
That's a hard question. I think it's actually healthy to be a bit jaded in the venture stage of the business. I think you should go into these things with eyes wide open, which entails that your chance of success is very, very low in any of these, and I'm talking primarily exploration stage companies at this point. It's very, very low under the best of circumstances. And by that, I mean, you have a very competent management team. They're technically sound. They are financially responsible, and commodity prices work in your favor. Because what you're doing is effectively running an experiment. And the problem, you know, you can run an experiment in the lab for a couple dollars, but to run a geological experiment, it costs millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars. So these things are designed to fail. And so you should go in understanding that the average exploration company will fail. The problem is these are rarely run under the best case scenario. So I would say one of the issues with junior mining in general is that there is a relatively low barrier to entry. You know, you don't really need a tremendous amount of technical skills, particularly somewhere like here in Vancouver. You don't need a lot of experience. You just need to like slap together a deal and be able to convince someone to give you money. So there's a relatively low level of competence in this sector, and there are, you know, business leaders that, you know, could barely lead a windshield washing business anywhere else in the world. And that's a real challenge. And then, you know, part two of that is the challenge with a business like mining and why it's such an opportunity is that there's so much opacity, right? There's so many unknowns. You don't know what's in the ground until you drill it. You don't know the grade. You don't really know how permitting's going to go. You don't know if there's going to be First Nations issue. You don't really even know the commodity price. And so that's the opportunity, because if things work out in your favor, you get big wins. But it's really a lot of unknowns. The beautiful thing, if you're a mining promoter with minimal ethics, if there's a lot of unknowns, is you can just talk shit and lie about everything. And you can't ever really be held accountable to your lies because there wasn't enough information to prove that you were lying. So it's an industry that attracts liars and people that, let's just say ethically challenged, that would not be able to survive in more transparent sectors. So yeah, I think coming in jaded is a healthy position to start from.
Okay. And are you more jaded now than you were 3 years ago?
I would say I'm more realistic. I'm more realistic than I was, you know, 3 to 5 years ago. I mean, you have to remember, I had worked in the mining industry for, you know, 15 years prior to starting the newsletter. So I was pretty aware of the kind of people that existed in this space and the probabilities of success. And for the most part, we did a very good job of choosing the right management teams that we invested in. But I won't say we never got it wrong. We certainly did get it wrong a couple of times. And then as I get older and more experienced in this, there's fewer and fewer people I'm willing to work with.
And when you said many of them are liars, the concrete evidence, and it's hard to pin down their lies, but some of the concrete evidence you would look for, I would assume, would be what they pay themselves, how they steward the money that they raise as they are selling this blue sky. What do they do with the money once they get it in the till? And also, like, one thing I look for is what forward-looking statements do they make? And do they at least follow through and give that forward-looking information or the result of it to investors. So if you're going to sell a drill program, but you have the drills in-house, but you don't put those out in a timely and complete manner and clearly communicate that, to me, that's a form of deception.
You know, Bill, what I am trying to look for recently, the last few years, is companies that are shareholder-led, not management-led. I think this is the best solution to this problem, in that there are different types of mining companies in the world, and there are some that are run by professional managers, effectively. They're like hired gun CEOs. And the problem with that is they are not major shareholders of the company. And that doesn't really matter, you know, if you're running General Electric or Procter & Gamble or whatever, because those companies are, you know, multi-billion dollar companies. They can go pay their CEO $10 million a year, and they have a ton of accountability to the board. And if they don't perform, they're gone. The issue of junior mining companies is they don't make any money, right? So there's a finite amount of cash in the bank. But if I'm a CEO that doesn't own any stock, my personal priority is to pay myself as much money out of that cash as possible, as I can get away with. That's what I would do. If that were me, that is exactly what I would do. I would be like, I need to get paid more because that's the only way I win here. The issue for that is it's not a profitable business. Most of the boards are incompetent or incapable and provide very little oversight. And so the CEO just effectively overpays themselves. And overpaying is like a pandemic within the mining industry. Like, for running these little rinky-dink $20 million companies, people making like $1 million a year is insane. And so what I'm trying to do is focus on companies that are led by shareholders, either at the manager level or the board level, who are major positions at that way outweigh compensation, right? So that they can say, you know, if this works and we do X, Y, Z and make a discovery or build a mine or whatever we say we're going to do, I'm going to make tens of millions of dollars. The $200,000 I'm paying myself per year is irrelevant into the success of that. Because me, as a shareholder, I don't get a salary, right? I'm only compensated based on the wins. I'm only compensated based on escalating share price. And we talked about this the other day. That, you know, just yesterday, I wrote up a stock for our subscribers at Resource Insider. I went into it exactly for this reason. I almost never make stock picks on the market. We almost always have done private placements. There's only been a handful of stock picks we've ever done. But I wrote up this one because of this unique situation. It's a company called Mayfair Gold. It's on the TSX Venture. It's been around, listed for 3 or 4 years. I invested a small amount of money just before listing, and I've held it, most of it since then. I think I've held 90% of my position. Well, Mayfair is under a really interesting scenario right now. So they have a professional management team that was brought in. But there are several major investors, and two of them are actually my friends from university. They work at an investment firm and a brokerage firm. And so they're big shareholders of this company. And the third really big shareholder is a group called Muddy Waters. And Muddy Waters is a short selling firm based out, I think it's Austin, Texas. They're US based. And they don't do much in the mining industry, but they've made two big trades that I'm aware of to date. So they shorted Asanko Gold very, very successfully. This was probably 2018, 2019, somewhere around then. And then they also bought a huge position in a company called GT Gold. They bought it all in the market. They got unhappy with the chairman. They went activist on it. They tried to roll out the chairman, get rid of him, and ended up forcing a sale to Newmont, who bought the company at something like a 40, 50% premium to what they were trading at. $400 million. So they have now gone activist on Mayfair. So they're trying to replace the board with a slate of their own directors. And they've made the claim that the board and senior management are not acting in the best interest of shareholders. You know, they've released some very, shall we say, aggressive press releases to this effect, basically claiming that the board is overpaying themselves, the management is being overpaid, and that not only that, they've issued themselves all the options available to the company. And maybe it's worth explaining why that's a big deal. Because Canadian company, you could public company, you can basically issue options up to 10% of your outstanding shares. So if you have 100 million shares outstanding, you can issue 10 million options. And you're able to award these options to management, to the board, to consultants you bring on, to new management. And you do this because you want to, exactly what I was just saying, economically incentivize people in terms of getting that share price up, and you want to reward them. And honestly, these little mid-tier tiny gold companies, they don't have the money for huge salaries that a Barrick or a Newmont does. So they need to incentivize people with equity. But it's typically the best practice of a company, especially a company that's only a couple of years, 2 or 3 years old, is to leave a pool of options available to bring on new hires, to bring on new management, to bring on new board members. And the reason for that is, as a mining company progresses from exploration to pre-feasibility and feasibility and development and construction, it requires very different skill sets. So it requires different technical, financial, market skill sets. So the management team and board should be evolving over time to bring in those expertise to face those challenges, right? An exploration geologist is not well suited to build a mine. And a guy who builds a mine is probably not well suited to run a mine. And those are all different, very valuable skill sets. So when you issue all the options early on in a company's life, you lose a lot of the tools available to build the management team and board that you may eventually need as the project progresses. So in this case, Muddy Waters has taken exception to this. And they are pushing very, very hard to remove the board right now. Now, do you want to know why I'm investing in that?
Because you're going to, because you think you can make money. Tell us why you think you're going to make money.
Okay, here's why I think I'm going to make money. This is my thesis here. Muddy Waters is already super long this stock. They've been buying in private placements. They've been buying in the market. I don't know what their average cost is. They own over 10% of the company. They're a reporting shareholder. But I'm going to guess, because it's somewhere between $1.50 and $2 a share. Somewhere in that is the best I can tell. Right now, they're trading at just over $2 a share. They've put a lot of money to work here, and so have several other investors. They say, their consortium of investors, they publicly said this. I have no proof of this, but they've publicly claimed that they control 50% of the stock, and they're going to vote the board out. So it sounds likely that this will happen if they want that. Now, okay. So they've put a lot of money in. They've put a lot of their funds. So they're putting their shareholders in. They're saying, we're taking over this company because we can do a better job. That's basically what they're telling the market. So say this works. They remove the board. They put their guys in. They sit on. The head of Muddy Waters has appointed himself as one of the board members, or as trying to be one of the board members. What would you do in that situation? I'm just very publicly said, I'm smarter than these board members. I'm going to take control and I'm going to do a better job. Well, if that were me, I would want to be damn sure that the share price of that went up when I was in control. And if I control the fund and I had money, I would probably start buying stock, because I would say, look, I've increased my confidence. I know what's going to go on here. This is going to be great, blah, 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 blah. I really want to see that go up, because if I go and make this big, very public proclamation and kick out the board and replace them, and the share price goes down, I'm not going to be looking very good to my investors at that point. So I think you have they may be the biggest shareholder in the company, biggest or second biggest shareholder in the company, who's trying to take control, who's very, very motivated to see that go up. So we'll see what happens, but I predict, which is why I'm buying the stock, I bought it today, share price escalation. So that's kind of option one. Option two is, well, maybe the board doesn't want this to happen. And they say, look, we don't want these guys to take control. For whatever reason, we don't think they're qualified. We're better at this. These are the wrong people to run this company. Well, how do they do that? They might have to sell the company then. This is what GT did, right? When GT Gold was being taken over by Muddy Waters, they just sold the damn thing to Newmont and delivered a massive short-term return for shareholders. I don't know if the company is doing this at that point, but if I were them and I thought these bricks are coming in and they think they're so smart and they're going to ruin this company, we got to deliver value for shareholders today. So I look at it like a situation, like tails I win, heads I win. You know, again, could something go wrong here? Absolutely. You know, things go wrong in junior mining all the time. But when I look at the delta, right? Like, it's like, okay, what happens? Maybe Muddy Waters comes in. People are unhappy that they don't buy the stock. Maybe I lose, you know, 30, 50% of my money on that. Maybe the board wins and it peters out.
So this is a play on the financial incentives of two warring groups over this company.
Yes, exactly. And I feel like, my guess here is whatever happens, the share price needs to go up in the short to medium
term. Okay, but you interviewed on your show, you interviewed when you did podcasts, I listened to a long form of your show. You interviewed a fund manager that we both know, and he said that if management does him wrong, he has no problem destroying their company by selling his massive position so that that company never comes back from the dead. Has Muddy Waters ever done that? Did you look into that?
That's a good question.
I'm going to take down the whole ship. If the ship's not going to go where I want, I'm going to take down the whole ship.
They have not done that in the mining sector. Certainly. I know that to be true. Have they done that other? I mean, they actually have gone the other way, right? They short the company. So they actually bet. And then they bet on companies going down. And then they put out information that will help incentivize shareholders to leave. So I guess, could they go the opposite way on this? I would say this. They're so long this thing, they can't exit that position. I don't know this in detail. I would think the millions of shares that they have in this would be very, very, very challenging to exit in a relatively illiquid stock without completely crushing the share price. And I think these guys are not at a point, which is why they're going activist, where they want to take a loss on this. They want to take a win. They believe in the asset. And they want to make money on it, and they think they can make more money on it if they take it over. So is that impossible in your scenario? It's not impossible. You know, anything could happen. I think it's unlikely. That's what I would say.
And I would say they build their brand through conflict, right? Draws more attention to them when they muddy the waters.
They build their brand through conflict. It's a strategy.
Exactly.
I don't know if that's what I would want to spend my life doing personally, but I'm very happy to ride on the work of other people in place of debt on this conflict.
Jamie, my final
And that's the issue, right? Like, there's no catalysts in gold right now. Like half the good exploration
cutting of interest rates. What are you saying? Like, there's going to be guests or listeners that are going to say blasphemy. The cutting of interest rates. What do you mean? How is that?
Sorry. Let me rephrase this. Cutting of interest rates. There are lots of catalysts in gold price. Absolutely. Gold price has seemingly had minimal impact on gold equity price. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of people willing to buy gold equities right now because they don't know when people, like, money is going to flood back into that sector and they're going to go up. I've seen so many gold junior companies release good results and see their share price go down because investors are like, oh, good, this is a chance for me to get off this. There will be buying. And it's like a liquidity event and it has the opposite effect. So what I like about this is that there's a real catalyst. There's this potential board changeup. You have a very motivated shareholder that wants to see this succeed and has been holding stock. And to your point, it's attention through conflict. And there's going to be a lot of eyeballs on this. And that is something that the Canadian and Australian gold industries have been desperately lacking the last year.
Jamie, my final question for you deals with some of your long-form interviews that you did in 2018 and 2019 on your show. That was a great discipleship tool for me. I remember listening to you interview mining sector experts for over an hour as I'm cutting my grass on my zero turn. So learned a lot from you in that regard. So thank you publicly. Want to say that.
I appreciate that.
When you're sitting down with the successful entrepreneurs or thought leaders in the mining investment sector, what are you trying to get? Are you trying to get insights, just learn their thought process, inspiration? Can you share with me, like, your goals going into those conversations?
I've done a lot of different podcasts, and some have been, in my opinion, and I think by our listeners, incredibly good, incredibly interesting. And some I think have been kind of boring, because I know there's been a few where, like, I've been bored doing this, and you've seen me do the podcast less lately because I kind of got bored. And the ones that were good to a T had one thing in common. And that was, I was interviewing someone that I was very interested in learning something from, you know, and that changed from different people, whether they were a geologist or a fund manager or an entrepreneur. You know, I work in the sector that they work. There's something about all those people that I admired, often something that I would have liked to learn from or emulate or learn how to do. And so that was the primary goal of all of my really good podcasts. It's like, you know, you sit down with Ross Beatty and you kind of say, okay, how did you do this? How did you start these companies? How did you build them? You sit down with Frank Giustra and like learn about how the sort of the how he looks at things financially and has called trends and has been able to, there's all these people that have had a tremendous amount of success. And, you know, me and many of the people listening to your show and my show wanted to understand that better and how they could, you know, emulate a little bit of that. And that was it. That was the ones that were great were the ones where I was genuinely curious of. And I got this right a few times, a lot actually, but I also got it wrong a few times, is when I would prepare questions, if I ever prepared questions that I thought other people wanted to know the answer, I found it didn't turn out that well. The ones that did well were the ones where I was like, what do I actually want to know about this person? And then I would just make a list of, you know, 50 questions, and I would kind of divide them into different topics, and then I would talk about those topics. And every time that worked really, really well. And I will do other podcasts, but I will choose my guests really selectively. And it'll be going to be people that I want to learn from. And I think that adds the most value to the audience. I think you do a great job of that as well.
Thank you, Jamie. I've enjoyed this conversation today. Before you leave, where should listeners find you on the websites?
Yeah, resourceinsider.com. If you're interested to learn more about what we're doing, sign up. It's free to sign up, and you'll get occasional newsletters from me when I have something that I think is interesting to see.
Excellent. Well, really appreciated this conversation. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you for listening to Mining Stock Education. Please subscribe and share this show with like-minded investors. Connect with us at miningstockeducation.com and sign up for our email list to stay in touch. Much success to you as you learn about, invest in, and profit from mining stocks.
The mining business is one that generates gigantic wealth. You know, a good drill hole that converts might cost $50,000 or $100,000, and it might discover something worth a couple billion.
There is no sector that I know of that has offered up as many predictable circumstances where there was the possibility, certainly not the certainty, but the possibility of 10-for-1 returns as there is in small cap and micro cap mining stocks. Concomitant with that, if you don't do the work, or even if you do the work and don't discipline yourself on the sell side, there are very few places in the world where you can lose as much money as quickly as in mining stocks too.
I just started to study up on mining stocks, and I just became fascinated because this is such a tiny sector and it's so volatile that either you could do really, really well, or you could pretty much get blown out of the water really quickly.
The mining sector is a very risky sector. It can take your money very, very quickly. Don't fall in love with stocks. Don't be overly confident. And just do your work as best you can. Do your very best. But don't fall in love and don't get too overly confident, because that's a recipe for disaster.
I have met, you know, professional retail investors that have made a tremendous amount of money on the junior mining space. Some of them aren't accredited, and they spend their days researching, talking to people, being on the phone, pouring through financial documents. But it requires commitment.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature, and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.